Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. My name is Zachary Strubeck. I am your host for the show, and I'm also a California game lawyer. Today, I have two guests with me. They're here to talk about indie game development and publishing through Microsoft. My first guest is Kathleen Harris, who I met.
Hi there.
Okay. Well, I met you at a Unity developer meetup in San Francisco this summer. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah. Hi, everybody.
And also joining us today is Tobias Zarles, who works with Kathleen, or Kathleen works with him. I don't know how to say that.
We work together.
Okay.
Perfect. Yeah. We're both game evangelists in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm in the South Bay. She's in the North Bay. So together we rule the area.
We rule the Bay.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, before we get into talking about Microsoft and indie developers and your jobs, I'd like to just hear about each of your backgrounds and how you got into the business and how you got, you know, started working with Microsoft. So Kathleen, let's start with you.
Cool. Yeah. So I was recruited right out of university. So I was studying computer science and engineering, and then joined this student game developer club and started making games through that student-run group, eventually becoming like vice president of the group, and then heard about this position at Microsoft with technical evangelism, and was really excited to just work with game developers and move out to the Bay Area that way.
I know that
and I've kind of just been hopping around doing different tasks for the role, talking with partners, talking to other game developers. So that's just kind of my background.
Awesome. Tobias, how did you get into business?
So long story short, in 2009, when I graduated college, I was president of the game development club at my school, and I wanted to get in the games industry. And I thought, man, getting a job is hard. So me and a friend decided to start our own company and make our own games. And as we were doing this, iPhone opened up its platform. We thought, oh, let's make a mobile game company. And turned out that was a very wise business decision to get into mobile gaming right as that platform started. So that ended up being my full-time gig. We expanded to a 3-person company, and I did that for 4+ years until I kind of fell into this role at Microsoft. I was evangelized by someone who was in my role back then, and they got us on Windows Phone 7 back when that came out. And I ended up falling in love with Windows Phone's platform. I ended up hanging out at Microsoft events all the time and talking to Microsoft people. And so when that person moved on to a different role in the company, and I knew that, you know, his job was open and we had become friends at that point, he recommended me for the role, and I became an evangelist a little over 2 years ago. And I was one of the first people to call themselves specifically game evangelist at Microsoft. Kat and I actually started pretty much the same week, although Kat started in a different role, and then realized that games evangelist is where it's at, and joined me. It's been a year now? How's it been?
Yeah, almost a year, I'd say, when I made the switch.
Very cool.
I think it was in November, December of last year. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, so let's address the elephant in the room. What is an evangelist, specifically a game evangelist, you know, for the listeners who have maybe never heard of that? What do you guys do?
it's literally preaching Microsoft. A lot of people hear it like evangelist and they think wait, what church do you work for? And, but basically our way to can think about our job is that we're kind of consultants. What a consultant would normally do. We help developers with code. We train them on, you know, whatever tool that they're using, or best monetization practices, or help them through the process of publishing. But we do so, as part, not just we don't charge them a fee. We are paid for by Microsoft as part of their goodwill towards developers. And specifically, we also help developers with any issues they might have with Microsoft platforms, Microsoft services, or Microsoft tools.
Exactly. And another half of our job as well is to create documentation to make it easier for developers to start using our technologies and our software through either side projects that we're doing and using third-party systems and then integrating them into Microsoft to actually see what type of technology indies or other startups are using, and seeing how difficult it is or how easy it is for them to integrate with the Microsoft platform.
Right. Do you have to?
So if you go to,
is part of your job sort of translating very technical stuff into more palatable language, I guess, for people to read and understand? Or are you staying on the technical side?
We're both technical people, and so our focus is technical subjects specifically. Our role is more geared towards what we call breadth evangelism. So we talk to everybody, and what's cool about that is that we get to focus on indie game developers, which is not just to say like, oh yeah, everybody we of small fry kind of thing versus like your Facebooks or your big companies out there. Mm-hmm. But we focus on small startups. We focus on people, maybe they're just getting into game development. Maybe they're, highly experienced and they're, just coming out with their first game and they're, a startup. And so we're often seeing new young companies tends to be our focus.
Right. Do you have a lot of people going from non-game software and moving into games and sort of needing help with that transition?
Yeah, actually, I've met a lot of people who have always wanted to be in the games and have been afraid to kind of jump in. Mm-hmm. The games industry is a really good one to be in. There's a lot of money to be made. A lot of apps are out there. But it's also very, very competitive. There's a lot of people making games. So it definitely can be scary if, people are not used to it or afraid to jump in or, if they're trying to do it in a full-time gig, obviously there's financial reasons behind them being worried.
Yeah, it's totally understandable. Is there anything you recommend that developers do, I guess, in the beginning? I usually recommend that you start your marketing a long way out to start to build awareness of your brand and your game that's upcoming while you're developing it. Do you work with them on things like that, or are you sort of strictly on the development end of things?
I'd say like mostly development. We gear more towards the technology and kind of what you're using to build your game out. Mm-hmm. And we try to, doesn't matter what platform, really we're just here to kind of help you kind of make the game as best as it could be, whether it's using Azure on your back end, or if you're making it in Unity or doing some other development to make it cross-platform or for PC. Mm-hmm. That's where I guess our expertise excels in.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we'll cross over and give advice from, what we have experience with. Like, as I mentioned before, I ran a company for a few years, so I've definitely talked to people about like the need to make sure, all your T's are crossed in your contracts, and definitely like I would say running your own company, maybe 20% of your time is development and the 80% time is marketing, is getting out there and talking to reviewers, is polishing the game, is bug fixing, is going to the community and letting people know like, hey, you can't just release this on the store and expect magic to happen. And you also talk about like monetization too, not just in a general sense, but we can help integrate monetization on our platforms, mm-hmm. Different ad services or in-app purchases. And so we kind of can blend design and technical with that, as design and technical are very closely related.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Catherine, you go to a lot of in-person events, right? Like I met you at that Unity developer meetup. Do you go to a lot of these events all over the country, or?
Yeah. We go to a lot of different, big events, small events, small meetups, large meetups. I normally stick around the West Coast. So again, I'm based on the northern part. So San Francisco, the Bay Area. Tobias does the southern part, but we also have counterparts that are in New York and Boston and Chicago and Dallas as well. That kind of
in LA,
right? In LA, so we kind of have different regions to cover. However, like if there's a huge event like Unity's big conference Unite in Boston, mm-hmm. we'll fly out there. More of us will tend to go to a larger event like that, or if Microsoft has our build event that happens in San Francisco, other evangelists around the country will come and fly in for that to help.
Okay. How big is the team of evangelists?
Of all U.S. field evangelists, I want to say like 60-something.
Yeah.
But it's kind of hard to, you know, keep track since everyone's has their specialty. And you know, there's probably a half dozen or so of us that focus specifically on game development. But, you know, we have people who are focused just on cloud and, you know, just on, you know,
machine
JavaScript, just on machine learning, you know, just on virtual, you know, or augmented reality. And Microsoft has many different facets of technology
Absolutely.
That we talk
yeah.
to developers about. So we try to have somebody on the team that kind of represents everything.
In the, as far as the game development evangelists go, or is it just the two of you that work with sort of the smaller indie developers, or is everyone working from anywhere from big developers to small developers? How does that work?
I think all of us on our team is focused on all kinds of developers, from okay. you know, very, very tiny to, you know, new startups. There's a separate team that deals with like those kind of more partnership relationship type things, right? Like very large companies, you know, money being exchanged kind of thing, you know, multi-million dollar corporations. And we're more focused on the tools being out there for companies of all size everywhere. And so we'll deal with some fairly large companies as well. It's not just, you know, bootstrapped operations, but we kind of deal with everyone that isn't like dealing one-on-one with Redmond already.
Right, right. Okay. How about schools and universities and game design programs and things like that?
Both of us go to schools all the time. I just spoke in front of a high school class talking to them about game development. We do college universities all the time.
Very cool.
Yeah. Since Berkeley is right next door, I tend to go there a lot and do a lot of engagement with the university there. But yeah, around the nation, we all have different universities that we go to, and all of us tend to try and get to high schools and middle schoolers and advocate for everyone should learn how to code type deal.
Yeah, I have a nephew in the Bay Area, and he, I think over the summer, went to a game design camp or school and that kind of stuff. I mean, when you start learning that, you know, I wish I had kept at it. I started to learn basic programming when I was very young, but I never really kept at it. So I think that's one of those things that it's super helpful, especially, you know, whether you go into games or not, just learning how that works. I mean, we live in a world where technology basically runs everything. And I think so many, no offense to millennials, but it's so many millennials don't really understand how their technology works. It just sort of works, right? Whereas when I was growing up, you sort of really had to know how to build your computer and, you know, do some, you know, DOS prompts and things like that. I mean, it seemed a little more complex. So I don't know. Maybe that's just the old man in me talking, but it seems like that.
Coding is definitely a big thing. We need to have more literacy out there for people. Even if, you know, you can't sit down on your computer and code your own programs, you need to be able to understand how your software works, right? Like people
exactly.
I don't necessarily know how to fix my car, but I have a general idea how an engine works and the parts it takes to make it work and, you know, why I need a spark plug.
Right. Well, you got me there. I'm not really a car guy. I can build a computer, but I can't really help my car.
I mean, I have no idea how my engine works in my car either. So
maybe it was a bad example.
Something's wrong with my car.
You're talking to the wrong people.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so let's go back to those events that you go to. Is it important for developers, you think, particularly smaller, newer indie developers, to be going to all these different events, whether they're meetups or game conventions, hackathons, game jams, all that stuff?
I think it's great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to kind of network, kind of figure out, like, who are the other people in your industry to either get support from or to kind of learn what techniques they're using and get more insight that way, as well as promote your own games. And maybe others can learn from you. And then you can kind of, what is it? Rising tide raises all boats, yeah. Kind of share the knowledge so that everyone can kind of succeed in this kind of a little bit cutthroat industry. But
well, game developers tend to be the nicest too. Like I've said at a couple, you know, meetups a few times. if you're making an app, you know, if I'm making a note-taking app, I have to compete with OneNote and Evernote. You know, those are some pretty behemoth type companies. And if my note-taking app is not better than those or does something vastly different than those, I'm probably not going to use it. Right. But if I'm making a game, as a gamer, I play lots of games. I'm always downloading new games. If I like one game, I'm going to like another game, no matter how similar or different it is. And so game developers don't really compete with each other in that sense. And they tend to benefit a lot from cross-promoting with each other, from sharing ideas, from talking about their challenges in design. And it's really nice that, you know, the attitude of those game developers is not really, you know, secretive, startup-y type, like, oh, you got to sign my NDA before you can hear about my company. And people tend to be pretty open books about themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, aside from those who play only one game, yeah, like you're saying, it's not a, like, you know, people that play World of Warcraft or something like that, and that's like all they play. But like people that are playing indie games like this, it's not really a zero-sum game, I guess, except for, you know, how much time do you have to play games otherwise?
I even question, like, there's, you know, oh, I only play one subscription-based MMO, but I probably bet that World of Warcraft player pulls out their phone and plays a lot of different games on the side, and they're always trying out new games for the next game, right? Because even if they, you know, they'll try Guild Wars 2 and then say, oh, it's not me, and then they'll go back to WoW. But if it was, and some percentage of them that was, they, you know, transfer over and that becomes their game. Because they're always trying something new, looking for the best thing for them.
Right.
Yeah. So do you often find new talent at these events? Like, are you finding new people and then saying, wow, I got to get this person signed up and working with Microsoft?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably, you know, our not so secret agenda too is, you know, to be out there, you know, meet people and say, hey, you've got really cool stuff. Right. Can I show you what we have to offer? We have some cool platforms you can work with. We have some cool tech. Hey, you know, is there anything we can help you out with? Since we deal with a lot of startups, Microsoft has a really great program for startups called BizSpark that if they're less than 5 years old, you know, they're an actual company, and they make less than $1 million a year, you can get pretty much most of the software Microsoft makes for free. You know, Windows 10, Office, $150 a month off your Azure hosting bill. So we say, like, hey, you want to try us out?
Yeah, it lasts for 3 years, too. So you have time to kind of build your game and kind of build that following, like you were saying, and promote it. And then you have that time to kind of, like, release it and see where it goes.
Hopefully
you also you get to keep the software you get within that 3 years. You just won't get the latest updates after 3 years.
Right.
That's great. So do you find that most of the people that you work with take you up on that and take advantage of that? Or
yeah.
A large percentage do.
Yeah.
Why not throw you free stuff and say yes?
It's kind of funny because a lot of people don't realize that we have this program out there. So half the time that we talk about it, or more than half the time we talk about it, a lot of indies and startups will be like, I didn't even know Microsoft had this program.
Right.
Didn't even realize it existed. So it's kind of just getting the word out to these developers who will then come back to us and be like, this was amazing. Thank you so much. Like, we didn't have any sort of capital to begin our game development. And because of this, we were able to, like, have the money to host it on a bunch of, like, different machines and get those licenses for certain software.
Yeah, well,
I don't realize Microsoft cares about, like, small companies as well, not just big companies that's what, you know, the bread and butter paycheck is. We know you're a bootstrap startup and you're not going to spend, you know, the $6,000 a year, whatever it is, for an MSDN account. So we'll just give it to you for free.
Right. Well, okay. So let me ask you, it seems like there's a problem or a disconnect between people finding out about these programs and do you think that having two human beings going out there and talking to people is the best way to get the word out? Or are there other ways that Microsoft is trying to get the word out about these programs?
Well, certainly not the only way.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not. There's a bunch of different programs within Microsoft that are trying to promote all the different programs and all the different technologies that we're trying to use to help developers. Evangelist is one. We have other marketing teams in Seattle that handle a lot of the other sort of conferences and online content to kind of promote BizSpark as well. Mm-hmm. And the other programs we have for high schoolers and college students that we try to get out either through the relationship we have through the universities or other type of university advertisements. Mm-hmm. To buy it. There's a lot more that I can't think of right now.
Well, it's also like, you know, our job is mostly helping out developers, whatever it is, you know, teaching them how to use the tools, making online training videos. And so we'll use things like, oh, hey, we have this BizSpark thing. And with that, we get all of these tools. And now let's show you how to use them. So it's less like our job is to go out there and just promote, you know, gotcha. BizSpark and sell these tools. It's more like, hey, we're there to train you how to use this stuff. And we can show you, oh, we also have these ways to get it for free, too. You don't necessarily have to spend thousands of dollars in order to try out our platforms or tools.
Perfect. Now, do you do a lot of this training in person or over the internet? How do you work with that? Since I assume that they're all over the U.S. and maybe all over the world.
Yeah, we speak at conferences and meetups very, very regularly. But we also try to, you know, because you only can talk to so many people in a room, right? A room's, you know, if you got a good room, you have 100 people in it. If you're, you know, at a major big conference, you get like 1,000 people. But, you know, we make videos and put them up on Microsoft's Virtual Academy, which is their kind of online learning resource, or Channel 9, where they have a bunch of different training videos. And then those videos can, you know, hit many, many, many thousands of views and help more people. So it's a balance.
Very cool. So how well do the Microsoft development tools integrate? Let's say someone's already developing for PlayStation or for mobile or something like that. When you introduce, are you introducing new tools into their ecosystem? And how well does it integrate with other things that they may already be using?
So a lot of our tools, like our largest one that we've been promoting for cross-platform development is our backend tool. So like with Azure, we do have iOS support for Azure as well as Android support, depending on what you're doing. So a lot of
I should say for people listening, if you don't know what Azure is, it's our backend cloud services. So that could be as simple as hosting, you know, a shared web page to as complicated as spinning up multiple Linux virtual computers in the cloud and, you know, running whatever computation you want on them.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Background. So yeah, we have support for some of those mobile services that we have, like notification hubs and, notification hubs. We have a couple for iOS and Android and documentation on how to get started with those, as well as Windows Phone and kind of the Windows platform. And what's really cool about the new Windows 10 and the new Microsoft Message is that we want to build once and then have your application run on all sorts of devices. So with Windows 10, you have this core application that you're writing, and depending on the device you're using, you would just have a specific API layer that would sit on top to call device specific information. So Windows 10 runs on your PC, on your Windows 10 phone, and then it can also eventually run on Xbox and IoT devices like Raspberry Pi 2s, and eventually any other sort of hardware that Microsoft comes out with. It will be the same. You can have your same code base that builds to a single binary that can just run on all these different devices.
And then another aspect is there's so many different roads of Microsoft. Like you're just talking about our tooling. You know, Visual Studio is one of the, you know, most popular coding editors out there that works with many different languages for many different platforms. We're actually the default editor for Unity on Windows now. So if you're a Unity developer, regardless of what platform you use, you're, you know, very likely now using a Microsoft tool to, you know, be able to develop for that. And even Visual Studio itself has an Android emulator in it now.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So how important do you think it is? Let's go back to the marketing and things like that. And maybe this isn't really your cup of tea, but when when I've gone to shows like PAX, right, they have an indie mega booth where they have all these indie developers there. Do you find that that's important for indie developers to be doing that kind of thing?
I'll take this one since I've actually, my company had a booth at PAX I think it was 2012. Time is slipping by now. I definitely think it's good. It feels really nice to be able to have your game out there and have people play it. And from a playtesting point of view, it was so valuable to watch hundreds of people play through the first few levels of your game over and over and over again. And, you know, you can get analytics, but it's a different experience to, like, physically watch people. So definitely from an exposure point of view, I think those can be really, really helpful. I think it really just comes down to the math equation of how much it's going to cost you, you know, if certainly if you have to travel and flights and hotel and booth fees and, you know, versus what benefit you'll get out of it. There's absolutely benefit there. It's not necessarily always worth the cost ratio, but there's definitely strong benefit.
Yeah, I mean, because between travel and getting the booth and equipment and everything, yeah, you're looking at thousands of dollars in expenses. So I can understand that's a pretty big decision for a developer who's probably, you know, probably either working on quit their full-time job or maybe working part-time to be able to develop.
And it depends on if you're trying to show the game at an early stage and get people's feedback and reactions from it versus you're just about to come out or just came out and you're trying to support your launch, or maybe you came out last year and you're trying to, you know, kick up your tail again and talk about the new features and this update that came out. And also different conferences cost different amounts, different fees. And so it can definitely scale.
Yeah, that can definitely be a problem. Especially when, if you have your marketing calendar stretched out very long. I had a guest on a few weeks ago who was marketing an indie game publishing company, and he was saying he recommends like a very short window for marketing your game, right? So it's sort of, you know, you flare up with your marketing and just a few months later, then you're releasing your game, right? So you don't have this prolonged years of marketing. And I know that there are a lot of games like that where you'll start marketing them years in advance and you're just, when it finally comes out, you think, wow, that's actually coming out. I thought it came out years ago because I started hearing about it forever ago. I guess that's one of the problems with game development is that it just takes so long, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on the project. There are games that come out quicker than others. That's not, you know, this is a recent example. The Beginner's Guide came out to like, what, one tweet, like a week or two before it came out, and no one had ever heard about it before that. Right. Maybe that's a weird exception to the rule based on the nature of what that game was, but I think it highlights that there's no universal path to success in game development. The road is still very much Wild West, so anything goes. Whatever you can find works can work.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the only thing we can agree on is that there really is no one way to do it. But that's okay, because, I mean, every game maybe has different strengths and weaknesses, and you have to take advantage of that.
So yeah, you'll definitely market certain kinds of games different than others. You know, going, trying to, you know, sell your Match 3 whatever puzzle game would be very different than trying to sell your, you know, story-based, dark, RPG, whatever.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So you guys, like me, you both travel a lot, right? Are you out of the country often, or are you staying mostly, like you said, on the West Coast, Catherine? But do you find yourself traveling? Give me a ratio, like how much are you home versus how much are you on the road?
It goes up and down. The month of October, I was joking to my friends that I only stayed 5 nights, maybe 6 nights in my own home.
Yeah.
Because I was traveling so much, it was just the time for hackathons and conventions. And so I was going to Seattle and then to LA and then San Francisco, but I wasn't actually in my home in San Francisco. I was at different events. So I just ended up crashing in hotels and then flying to Boston and then flying back to like LA and then going to Houston. And that was like a very travel heavy month. November is much, much calmer, so I'm only going to LA twice this month. And I travel a lot more than Tobiah, Because he just had a baby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have a 4-month-old at home, so I used to travel a lot more. And I also had a similar schedule in October, but not quite as bad as Kat's. It comes and go. I think officially I'd probably say it's like 20-25% of our time's on the road. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes translates to like 3 weeks in a row and then no travel for a month. Yeah. And other times it's, you know, just a quick weekend trip here and there to help support an event. Like I went up to Seattle a couple weeks ago just to help out with a student hackathon with some people because we only had one person in the team there. So they needed some extra hands.
Cool. So are you still working while you're on the road?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean that's yep. that's the whole
thing. Well, I mean, I know it is work going on the road, but I mean, is there sort of like you're interfacing with the home office or that kind of thing?
So our day to day job is basically mobile to the first place, right? Like our office, we could work from home. We work from our new Reactor space we opened up in San Francisco. Wherever we set up our laptop is pretty much where we're doing our job that
speaking
day.
Speaking my language, I love it.
Yeah, it's very convenient.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I I've had to go through some hurdles to be able to run a legal business over the internet, but it's definitely working out for me as well. And I travel basically always. So I definitely understand that there's issues that could happen. Do you have any particular tools that you use for working remotely? I mean, we're on Skype right now and I use Skype all the time.
Well, I was about to say Skype for Business is what I think everyone at Microsoft uses.
A Microsoft product, yes.
Yeah, to talk to people like on the Teams or whatever. Right. And I think that's how we mainly just communicate with each other. I mean, some of us will just like text if they aren't on their computer or they're at the physical event and can't really get a hold of them. Or, do you use another technology to get a hold of me or?
We'll sometimes jump around, but Skype for Business is definitely our main communication tool. I do some podcasting as well. And so since Skype for Business is like internal, talks, I'll tend to use like Skype for podcasting. I use OneNote all the time for, tracking notes and writing down ideas and planning stuff out. And Outlook, of course, is like, Outlook's a very big behemoth of a tool, and I wouldn't necessarily say, every company, every person, will benefit totally from it and all of its features. But if you work for a corporation that's fully in the Exchange stack and everyone's having the shared calendar, it's really, really nice to be able to like figure out, okay, where's Kat today? Oh, wait, I need to schedule a meeting with her. Okay, when's, open schedule assistant, pull these people in, invite here, automatically integrate with Skype for Business so that we create a private meeting room with a link that you can just, in Outlook, press a button and it automatically opens up. And that's a really great experience for working remotely as we do. As far as devices itself, we have our Surfaces that we take around everywhere. I don't know. What kind of gadgets MacBook do you have, Kat? I always carry around my portable podcasting unit, some paper business cards. I mean, that seems old fashioned. It's tends to be for people to remember you by. So I always try to keep those lying around.
I've been out recently, but I need to order some more. Thank you for the reminder. I mainly just have my Surface, my phone, and I recently got a little lavalier mic that you can just, it's an aux cable. So you just plug it in to your phone. You can just like start recording wherever. So that really helps because it's not big and bulky or clunky or anything. Of course my dongle for presenting because you have to have all the different adapters for the mini display port for your Surface.
Oh yeah, you get the one with multi heads that goes to HDMI or HDMI, DVI, VGA, and that's super useful because you never know what connection people are going to have. They'll say one thing, and when you show up, it'll be another.
Yeah, definitely. Wow, that's a good idea. That's something I need to start bringing along. I'm going to PAX South and hoping that my panels that I've suggested get picked up. So
I love PAX South. I went to the first one last year. It was so great. I'm not going to be able to make it this year because it overlaps with the Global Game Jam, but it was a really fun event.
Awesome. Well, if any listeners or anyone is on is at PAX South, feel free to look me up and meet up with me. Awesome. So yeah, I don't have an exchange server or anything like that. So I use a lot of different tools like Slack, Messenger, and I don't know. I tried Trello, but it's one of those things where I'm not diligent enough to keep it updated. When working with other people, I'm sort of lazy when it comes to, you know, keeping
It's really funny that you mentioned Slack. A lot of hackathons, like at least for students, have started to use it. And it's a really great way for the evangelists that go to those hackathons to then answer questions. Because these hackathons could be thousands of people. And you have some that are in random corners of the university or something, or in the stadium or wherever we are. We're like, we don't know where you are in the stadium, so we can't like just walk around to every table. And sometimes we do just be like, hey, do you need help? But with the Slack channel, they'll just ping us and be like, hey, I need help. I'm sitting here. I'm working with a Connect, so I can't just bring it to you. Can you come to us? And we're like, oh, that's so much easier. Or if it's like really simple question, we can just answer it right through there. And that way we can answer a bunch of questions and stay at the booth in case like other people want to come up and chat. So yeah, I'm like, yay, Slack, way to go.
Yeah, it's a great tool. I use it with other lawyers, and I mean, you can use it in game development as well. Yeah. Tobias?
Yeah, no, I agree completely. Slack is really awesome. We use it at a lot of events. Just because we're Microsoft people doesn't mean we only use, you know, Microsoft tools and software, right?
Yes. And that's fine. But I mean, look, you know, if you work there, obviously you're gonna have,
well, yeah, I mean,
not
it helps
bias,
it, like,
but I mean,
you know,
yeah, everyone's gonna be using it, right?
So. Yeah, it also helps that the tools that we create tools. Are like pretty good to begin with.
Of course.
Like, yeah.
Of course. All right. Let's talk about one legal issue, since this is sort of a legal podcast. So when a developer, now I'm told that you are allowed to answer this. So I know that there are some confidential things that about the process of sort of coming onto either ID at Xbox or Windows or something like that. Do you need to be a business entity, or can you be a sole proprietor when you sign up for either BizSpark or I think you answered about BizSpark. You have to
be. Yeah, so BizSpark, you need to be a company, whatever the legal framework of that is in your country, okay. Since it's BizSpark's an international program. For Windows Store, I believe you can sign up as an individual or as a company. Okay. And that's as you go through the sign up process, similar to other app stores, you can walk through that. And an ID at Xbox, you apply as a company.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I don't think they're. The requirements they're in, we work with people on an individual basis, and we care, especially right now in the program and the way you apply and talk about your specific game. It's less about you as a whole organization, more like, hey, show us the kinds of games we're making and let's start talking about them and how can we help you get them out there.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, it's all a process, you know, most indie developers that I know don't really know much about the business side of things. I mean, they get into it because they love development, not because necessarily they want to make a ton of money or start a business. But I think it's definitely important that, and I always say, if you're going to be selling a product out there, you know, you're taking people's money in exchange for your thing. You are a business, so you need to sort of act like one.
Absolutely. I mean, people need to, you know, think about like, hey, you got to think about what your taxes are going to be like, and you're not going to have any withholding, so make sure you save some money at the end of the year.
Yep.
And it's kind of, you know, kind of some simple, obvious stuff, but people don't think about it.
They
assume that they're not going to be as successful as they might be.
Right.
It's also like, if you're very likely working with more than just yourself, and you got to make sure all your contracts are in order, that, you know who's going to get paid what, and there's not necessarily a right answer but I've seen very often that people will work together, friends work together, it's implicit, and then suddenly money starts getting involved and it turns into bickering, and it can shut down development if it wasn't conversations that you hashed out at the beginning.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, I say it basically every week on this podcast, but yeah, you always have to have those contracts in place. Yeah, because my job
is worth repeating
because
so many people forget to do it.
Yep, absolutely. Are there any things that you could do as a developer to get yourself either banned from publishing with Microsoft or maybe kicked off of the platform. I know that I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago a guy who had threatened to kill Gabe Newell or something like that, and I think he got them kicked off of Steam. Something like that. Is there anything particularly bad that you can do to get yourself kicked out?
I don't actually know, Tobias.
We have some guidelines for each store. It's actually interesting because when you go to the Windows Store in particular, you can choose what countries you sell in. And so there's a certification process. And some people, you know, they'll just say, oh, I'll go to every country possible. And then they submit and then they get rejected because in, you know, a certain country, they have a different standard for what is acceptable and what's not. We have the guidelines out there. We try to make it, you know, as easy as possible for you to be able to kind of look over and figure out, you know, where you can go and what's going on. And generally, if you are doing something wrong, I imagine, you know, if you do something really, really terrible, you know, we might be more upset, but you'll generally get either rejected from the approval process, or if it, you know, it does end up on the store and then it's complained about, a Microsoft person will email you and say, hey, we're pulling this because of these reasons. So okay. If you can change XYZ, we can put you back up.
Okay. Very good. All right. Well, we are running out of time. So that's going to wrap up this episode of Legal Moves. Thank you again to both my guests, Tobias and Catherine.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.
I had a wonderful time. Where can our listeners find you too? Both professionally and maybe personally. Like, do you have Twitters and things like that?
Yes. we both have blogs and Twitters. So my blog is kahari.com. And Kahari is like my email, so that's really easy to remember. And my Twitter is @KatTheHarris. So... Okay, those are like the two major things.
Okay, I'm going to put all those correct spellings and things like that in the show notes for this episode, just in case.
Yeah, you'll definitely want that for me because my Twitter and my email is my name. It's TobiahZarlez. That's okay. Tobias Arlez on Twitter. Email me, TobiahZ@Microsoft.com, or go to my blog, TobiahZ.com. I also do a podcast called Be Indie Now, where I interview indie game developers and talk with them about their development. It's less technical and more going into the design side of things. I haven't released an episode super recently, though, because I just had a baby 4 months ago, but I'm already recording some episodes now, and I'll get back into the swing of things very soon.
Very cool. So is that, that's not a Microsoft affiliated thing? Is that your own?
No, that's just my thing on the side.
Awesome. No, I love it. I love podcasting. This is relatively new for me, but this is
I'm addicted to podcasts. I'm always have them on.
Yep. All right. Well, and if you're looking for me, you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. You can read about the legal aspects of game development, and make sure to help us out and review us on iTunes. I say it every week, but no one does it. So please go on iTunes and click 5 stars and make us all happy. And you
this is a general statement for all your podcasts.
Yes.
Do that to every podcast you listen to.
I think maybe if there was the problem is it's not endemic to the podcasting experience, right? So you have to go outside to an external link or something like that. Well, maybe not. I guess if you're using – I don't use iTunes or anything like that to listen to podcasts, so maybe that's the problem. But there's no easy way to jump on there and do it. Well, I guess
that's – Yeah, I agree. I use Pocket Casts, so it's kind of out of my way to go.
Right. And it's if there was a way to scream into your microphone and say 5 stars, maybe that would work, right?
Yeah.
Keeps it all on.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. And I'm doing a Patreon as well. So go to patreon.com/legalmoves to donate to the campaign, help upgrade the show. I'd like to make it video and do some other cool things. So, that's it. I will check you out on the next episode of Legal Moves.